Hello, just a quick bit before this week's episode to let you know that we have a Patreon you can subscribe to if you like what we're doing here and you want more of it. You probably already knew that. We don't stop going on about it. What you didn't know is that you can currently get a little free trial, so you know exactly what you'd get as part of your subscription. You can head to patreon.com/whatismusicpod or follow the link in the show notes to get your first 7 days free. All you need to do is pick which tier you'd like a free trial of. The Biggest Mates tier is the one that has all the extras in it. And then for 7 days, you are free to listen to any episode we've released in the last 6 months. You can cancel any time or just leave the subscription rolling if you like what you find. It's charged monthly. And during any month, as part of that Biggest Mates tier, you'll get ad-free episodes of this show every Monday. You'll get a brand new episode of our new Manic Street Preacher show every month. 2 episodes every month of the Ultimate Playlist, our themed playlist show, where we talk about all kinds of different music, different artists, different genres, different eras, and 1 or 2 bonus episodes every month, depending on the length of the month. That's 2 episodes every week. There's also other tiers to trial. One that is just the Manic Show and ad-free What Is Music episodes, and another that is just ad-free What Is Music episodes. But hey, if the first 7 days are free, why not try a bit of everything? Plus, all tiers include access to the exclusive subscriber-only Discord where we discuss the shows, the bands we've covered, various music topics, and loads of other stuff, including some games that the friendly community have devised themselves. So head on over to our Patreon page now to claim your free 7-day trial. Go to patreon.com/whatismusicpod or follow the link in our show notes. See you there.
Steve, you got any big news to tell us?
Yeah, I'd love some big news, actually. It's been a few weeks since we've had any big news.
Yeah, Steve, got any big news?
I came across a head-on collision the other day.
It was big news for them. I mean, for that person.
Yeah,
big news. A significant part of their day, I reckon.
You told us about this. Everybody was fine. It was fine, right?
It was all fine.
Apart from the man that was in Steve's boot, but that was unrelated.
Yeah.
technically, he was fine from the crash, but bloody hell.
Not fine later. In general, yeah.
Yeah, that was very surreal. Just turned the corner and it had just happened and I'd got out, checked everyone was breathing. Everyone was somehow fine. The cars barely existed anymore. Wheels were off and stuff.
Wow.
It's the first time I've seen airbags. I thought of Radiohead.
Did you actually?
Yeah.
You thought of the song Killer Cars, I imagine? There's a Radiohead B-side called Killer Cars.
Thought about airbag.
You thought the song Lotus Flower because one of the cars was a lotus.
Airbag. Thought about airbag because of the airbags.
Did you think of the song Nude because the man in your boot was nude? Anyway, hello. Welcome to What Is Music, a music podcast about music. We are a podcast that focuses on discographies in their entirety, doing deep dives on one artist at a time. And you join us for season 6, which is called Are We Enjoying This? A critical analysis of the history, cultural impact and music of REM. We're going through their entire career, album by album, track by track, asking questions like, does context matter when you're listening to music? Does knowing the history of an artist affect your appreciation of their output? And this season, we are, of course, asking, are we enjoying this? And to be clear, we're asking, are we enjoying this in regards to the band REM? Not are we enjoying this in regards to this, the 6th season of our podcast, which is called Are We Enjoying This? And which you may or may not be enjoying. I'm Adam Scott Glassman. I'm a big music nerd. I'm a big fan of REM. With me, as always, is someone who said they do not care about art or talking about art or talking to me and doesn't often relate personally to music. It is, of course, Lucas Wade.
Oh, that's me. Yeah.
In the middle of that, we have someone who can appreciate context, art, and subject matter. And it's just kind of learning how to convey that in the form of words. It's Steve Murphy.
What's up, party people?
That's a lot of energy. That's a lot of energy for the third episode of this deep dive into life's rich pageant.
Energetic album, man.
It's an energetic album. Yeah, it's an energetic album. It's an energetic. It's quite late at night. On this podcast, we're exploring the entire discography of REM, and we are partway through our deep dive into life's rich pageant. I'm pretty convinced that we got halfway through. I think we split the album in half. But we'll see. We'll see, won't we? We'll see by playing
this song.
This song.
and look to your hand.
Could I have realistically played New Year's Day? Because it's got like just like a bit of a piano in it.
Well, but
like,
yeah,
you know,
the piano bit doesn't sound like New Year's Day. It sounds like...
It does sound a bit like the East Street Band. Yeah, I'm going to avoid saying its name.
What's my first line here? I really wish I could just literally just share my screen just to show you it. But yeah, Adam obviously loved this because it sounds like East Street Band at the beginning.
No, I'd never made that connection until Lucas just connected it for me.
Because I'm better at music than you is the thing.
I do have to say, even the beginning of your sentence, Adam obviously loved this song because it's probably not.
Because Adam doesn't love this song.
This is the one of the ones that I really like rather than love. Mm-hmm. I think I loved every song that we've had so far, and I really like this one.
Is it one of the lesser ones because it suffers from Kevin Carter syndrome?
Because it's just, well, if you're going to say that, then Cuyahoga's got that right.
Oh, yeah. Because the chorus is just... Da-da-da-da-da-da, hyena, da-da-da-da-da,
hyena. I said this.
Also, who is Yena?
I said this on the episode for Murmur when you had the same criticism of Catapult, right? It's not the same as Kevin Carter. Thing about Kevin Carter is that the chorus is the guy's name repeated and the verse is just a description of the man. Like, this, if this was a description of a hyena and the chorus was hyena, or if the lyrics in Catapult, if the verse lyrics in Catapult were like, the handle is made of wood, there's an elastic bit on it, you use it to throw things, Catapult, Catapult, then I think you'd have a point. But there's so many songs that are just the title repeated that you can't level the Kevin Carter criticism at every song that we come across.
But the verses is just the word hyena. Sorry, the chorus is just the word hyena, and the verses is obviously there's the laughing at the start, like a hyena.
Sure.
And then the first line is like, they like to laugh, they sound like they're laughing, they hunt in packs, they're kind of like dogs, they're kind of like cats.
Whoopi Goldberg played one in The Lion King.
Yeah.
You're replying to me, yeah, what he said. What he said.
I mean, obviously that's not what the song is about. So aside from the content, they bring the energy back up here. It's a bit of a little bit more of a raucous punk banger, but infused with that softer aspect of the piano.
Is it one of the older ones?
It's old-ish. It's from the Fables era. We saw them perform it in the Fables commentary episode we did. It was in contention for Fables of the Reconstruction, but they left it off because it was too fast, and for this they recorded it even faster and it made it on. I mean, Steve, I think you probably respond to this quite positively. This seems like a Steve kind of vibe. You responded to the live version very positively.
Yeah, no, I liked the live version because I was like, I recognise this because I've heard this already. It's one of their newest songs.
Yeah.
But I wouldn't say this stands out at all for me, really.
Maybe
like,
that's
again,
what it is. Yeah.
I don't know. Like, what? If we can quickly go back to the title of the song repeated thing. I love that thing they do, and we've talked about it before, where Stipe is doing the name of the song, but the complex lyrics are underneath. So he's almost doing the backing vocals, but it's louder.
Yeah.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, absolutely.
The fronting vocals.
The fronting vocals, yes.
Mike Mills has like a whole other chorus that's happening behind the repeated words.
Yes. Yeah. The best thing about this song, of course, which makes the song, is the bit where it goes, the town is safe again tonight. And then it goes into hyena. There's so many good bits on his album.
That careening thing that he does with his vocals is always very impressive to me, and I can't actually replicate it. It's just you're doing a pretty good job of it, I have to say. Okay, well, we can get... It's obviously not about a hyena, which is what makes it different to Kevin Carter, because the Kevin Carter thing is just he was a man who was a photographer. His name was Kevin Carter.
But there's literally laughing of a hyena at the start. It's about a hyena, man.
Yeah, but... Okay, so Stipe was reading Aesop's Fables and set out to write a song that used a hyena as a metaphor for power, Lucas.
Yeah,
so it is about a hyena, but the hyena represents something different. It's a metaphor. Hyenas operate in darkness. They're scavengers. They laugh. So it's actually probably a really good metaphor for like insidious power, actually.
But they're not in power, are they? Because they're like the underlings to the evil lions.
You're thinking specifically of The Lion King, I think.
Yes.
I think
my only experience with hyenas, I'll be honest.
Really? That's interesting.
Have you ever met one?
No, not in the flesh, but we've done a few Skype calls and we might meet up next month.
Nice. Christmas? I'm surprised. People are pretty busy around December normally.
Yeah, he's got nothing on. I really like the sense of place and the scene setting in the song. Nighttime fell like the opening in the final act at the beginning of time. It's very nice. And it seems to almost tell a story of a hyena stalking a particular town. No doubt also a metaphor. But it reminds me of Miles Standish Proud, that line, and Miles Standish and his raids on Native American villages. Stipe has said that the song is specifically about Mexico and the US beginning to engulf that culture as well and doing it so boldly at the time. Hence the line, the only thing to fear is fearlessness. The bigger the weapon, the greater the fear. And we talked about this actually during the Radiohead season, who wrote songs in the 90s about US-owned factories in Mexico. Do you remember this? The poor conditions and the awful pay, the ecological destruction of it. And REM are touching on that here. And of course, 1986, I think, is the year Radiohead formed. And this would have been an important album for Radiohead, well, for Thom Yorke specifically. And I wonder if, you know, that might have been his way into some of the more kind of like political stuff, especially in sort of like the Central American sort of stuff that this album touches on, because it's not the first time it comes up.
It seems very Hail to the Thiefy, doesn't it, this one, actually?
Kind of does, yeah. That theme is picked up in another song.
Lyrically,
and
I mean.
In my argument, it's the next song, but it's not the next song that we're going to play. And also that fact reinforces my argument. I think that's the end of side one. Okay, I think Hyena is the end of side one. But what we have is what I think is a hidden track. Are we ready to hear the hidden track?
Well, I have one small little thing about Hyena.
Yeah, go on.
Which is just that this is the first song where I actually went, there's some good bass.
That's interesting.
It's the first time I actually stood out with it, I was like, there he is. There's bloody, at first I wrote, there's bloody Bill Berry. And then earlier on in this episode, you referred to Bill Berry as the drummer, and I quickly went into my notes and I changed it to Mike Mills.
Is it tripping you up because of Bill Berry bass? Are you like trying to like...
No, it's because they're both the ones with the alliterative names. So yeah, like Michael Stipe, that's fine. The other one...
He is REM.
Peter Buck, who is REM, like that's fine because he's, you know, and then it's the Bill Berry, Mike Mills, like interchangeable.
I don't mean to call you out on this, but we realised there's one album you didn't listen to with headphones. Did you listen to this one with headphones?
Yeah, I mean, I think
the bass is...
I don't think I did it with no headphones because I listened to almost all my music with AirPods.
Oh, yeah. It was one that you thought was lo-fi, and then you heard it on the episode we did, and you were like, oh, yeah, it's not.
Maybe the difference was listening to it with good headphones.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe, yeah.
I would like to counter your bass argument. I'm going to accept it on Fall On Me. I don't think there's prominent bass, because that's not the thing that you're mainly listening to on Fall On Me. You know, it's the vocals. Begin the Begin, you've obviously missed the excellent bass line where it goes, do, 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 boo, do, boo, do. Which is great. It's one of the best moments of the song.
But it's not like all over the neck like he has been in other places.
No, it's not. There is a slight change. These Days has that bit I pointed out with the stuttering, the rising bass line in the chorus. Cuyahoga opens with a bass riff.
But again, it doesn't slap. It's not like a slap. I'm talking about like the surprising bass that I've heard on a lot of other albums where it's like he's just surprisingly all over the place, you know?
It's interesting. That is interesting. I do think that the sound that they have on this record is much more of an amalgamated, it's much more of a band sound, and so you don't get the standout moments as often, I think. Interesting.
And very, very quickly before we move on, very importantly, we mentioned Lion King, Hyena. Jeremy Irons rhymes with lions.
Thank you. thing. It's only a minute.
We haven't even got to the like the vocals.
I know. I've not even got to the vocals. Yeah, I know. I know. Do you remember what I said about Can't Get There From Here, where it was like an example of like if the album was a photo album, that's the one where it would be like, okay, let's do a silly one. Guys, this is the silly one. Let's do it. Let's do a little silly one. And we were talking about the album being immediate. I think even when you get to the little fun silly one, I think you immediately go, oh, it's the little fun silly one. Like, you're like, yeah,
yes.
Of course it is. And I like that REM are fun. You know, like,
yes,
Mike Mills like has been quoted as saying, we go into the studio to have fun, not to root out any home truths. Now, it's REM, so don't take that on face value. But there's an element of truth in that. They started as a party band doing covers, and I don't think that ever truly leaves them for the entirety of their career. And there weren't many rock bands putting fun little things like this on their albums. It's got accordions and congas and that like high falsetto harmony, and Stipe is singing through a megaphone when the vocals come in. What did you guys make of it?
I really like it.
It's a fun one.
Yeah, it's like a little
it's kind of a vibe. Greek. It's like Mediterranean-y. Kind of.
I think it's very specifically Latin. It was originally called salsa.
I was so desperate for it to end the way that it did. I was so happy. And I was like, yes!
Yeah, lovely.
Because it needs it. If it didn't do it, like, it would have lost a point. But the fun one, there's some very sort of ominous kind of lyrics, right?
It's difficult not to think of the stuff we've already been talking about, the revolution or the violence that forms countries because of the other stuff that surrounds the song on the album.
When they're doing a fun one,
yeah,
it's as fun as REM will go.
I will fight and you will fight and we will fight together again underneath the bunker in the hills. come on, like, it's not as fun as REM will go. This is the band that do Shiny Happy People, my guy. Like, they always have a silly one. It's a fun thing. It wasn't on the track listing, originally called Salsa. And so it has an interesting place on the album, I think, as almost a scene setter for the opener of side two. Hyena is about Mexico, perhaps not obviously, but we know that now. Side two opener has Guatemala in the title. So in between these two songs about Latin America is a Latin influenced song that references revolution. So it's like a little scene setter without being an important part of any kind of narrative, if you want to see this album as having a narrative. And it's a narrative that kind of continues from the end of side one, which I consider to be Hyena, to the beginning of side two. What do you think of my take on this being a little fun hidden track?
I think it makes sense. Obviously, I didn't know any of that because on Spotify, it's just another song.
Mm-hmm.
And I just thought, oh, it's just them doing a little interlude, doing a little silly little ditty. Which is fine because people do that on albums. They just do a little ditty.
Works for both. Works both ways around, I think. Whether you want to see it hidden or an important part, yeah.
On the vinyl, is there a large gap or is it played as the next track?
No. But we'll talk about that a little bit later as well, actually. So we're on to the supper side with the opening track, The Flowers of Guatemala.
Lovely. Initially down as maybe a bit of a low light.
Initially,
because it is initially, because it it's very much the slowest one so far, and it's not doing as much, and it gets a bit trudgy until it gets to that bridge with the euphoric guitar, and my brain leaves my body, and I piss myself.
Well, that is one, you know, I think people have levied that this might be a duller song than some of the rest, but it's at least remarkable and notable because it does contain something that I don't think we've had in an REM song so far, which is a guitar solo.
A guitar solo, as much as it is a guitar solo.
Let's hear the guitar solo. Yeah, the band are changing the way they're working. They're breaking their own rules. They're at one point like, no, we're not going to do rock and roll cliches. There will be no guitar solos in REM. And here we are on their big rock album with a guitar solo.
A guitar solo that sounds like, I mean, I know it's before them, but it sounds like Mannix.
Does it?
Yeah, I think so.
I think a lot of guitar solos sound quite similar. I don't really get the fuss around solos. There's like a couple of solos that I like, but mostly they're like
go on, name a solo you like.
The Everlasting by Manic Street Preachers is an incredible guitar solo. But this one doesn't feel indulgent. This feels like an addition to the song rather than look how good I am at guitar. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, because it's like three notes.
imagine that was him showing off. Like, guys, you ready? Are you ready?
I think it's absolutely lovely. I think the song in general is a very nice section of the album where it needs to come down a little bit. That is in service because it's so emotional. And then it when it comes back into the chorus after, is it the chorus it comes back into?
Yes.
It seems like it has so much more weight since that release than it did in the beginning of the song. I quite like that. I wouldn't say this is a highlight by any means at all. But I initially found it quite boring.
It's interesting to me that thing that you said about it needs to, you know, it's important for it to come down at this point in the album, whatever. Now consider that it's the opener of side two.
That's interesting, isn't it? I mean, it's doing a thing, though.
It's doing a thing, but it's not an opener with the most vim and vigor behind it.
No,
is it?
Not at all.
I think it's one of like the clearer examples of the REM push and pull, the tension and release, the verse and the chorus structure that they often operate in. It's a small, quiet verse with a much more open and wide chorus. In terms of what it's about, there is help on the sleeve. The thing that is next to it on the track list is Flora Amanita, indigenous to Mesoamer. Flora.
Well, before you get into that, I felt like the song has got a kind of psychedelic feeling to it, which when I looked up Amanita makes a lot of sense, which is
lovely.
Very cool. Which I'll let you go into. Yeah,
it's Amanita muscaria is a flowering hallucinogenic mushroom, which is native to Mesoamerica. It is present in Guatemala. It's a fun observation. You know, it sounds a bit psychedelic. It's a hallucinogenic mushroom. You know, it grows in Guatemala. That's a fun observation, Steve. The fun ends there. Guatemala was a country that had heavy US involvement and still did in the 80s. And in 1954, the democratically elected president of Guatemala, Jacobo Arbenz, was proposing an increase to people's wages and enacting land reform. So the country had more say over who owned the land. And this threatened the corporate interests of the Guatemalan elite class and of the United States of America, and was perhaps a little bit too close to left-wing socialism. So they led a military coup against Arbenz. This ended the Guatemalan Revolution, which had been going on for 10 years at that point, and the US installed a military dictatorship led by Carlos Castillo Armas, who was just the first in a series of US-backed authoritarian rulers in Guatemala. Progressive policies were all rolled back, leading to a series of leftist insurgencies across the whole country. It triggered a civil war that lasted from 1960 to 1996. And during the civil war, atrocities against civilians were committed by both sides. When I say both sides, 93% of those violations were committed by the US-backed military, which included a genocidal, scorched-earth campaign against the indigenous Maya population in the 1980s. And that's where this song takes place. There's an ongoing civil war between civilians and a military dictatorship, and a systematic extinction of an indigenous people that was being propped up and supported by the US government. Peter Buck has a quote about the direct inspiration point for the song. He said, 40 people a week disappear in Guatemala. Why? Where do they go? Why do we support that? The song doesn't mention political oppression or the death squads, but I think it gets it across. So it's similar to Hyena. It's in metaphor, or it's in adjacent imagery. It does talk about the place being beautiful, and the flowers are a symbol of that beauty. But the second verse does have that kind of darkness creeping in with the line, "There's something here I find hard to ignore. There's something here I've never seen before," I think is what it is. And how this is eventually covered by flowers. The flowers cover everything. And there's a weary air of resignation to it, I think, as though it's part of a cycle that we have seen time and time again, as though it's part of nature. And so it is returned to nature when nature covers over it. I've also like always thought of a flower that covers everything as being somewhat like pervasive, like a creeping vine. And I draw a parallel from that to the US government kind of having its fingers in everything, installing roots where you can't see them, you know.
Like that weed on the Murmur artwork.
Kudzu, yeah, absolutely. And that pervasive feeling, similar to Cuyahoga, it's in the composition too. You have that very pretty guitar line, but there's an ominous guitar feedback beneath the verses, almost like a much more subtle version of the intense humming of evil. And they do that in a few songs going forward, and there's a song named after the fact that they do it in that song on a forthcoming album as well. I think that's really interesting. I think it's interesting that they have that compositional ear to put the darkness that isn't necessarily up front until you look into it, you know?
I mean, I made a Mannix comparison with the solo, but all of that, big Mannix energy. I mean, obviously it's before, so it's not big Mannix energy, but you know what I mean.
Same with Begin the Begin as well, right? Like, I had all those historical references and stuff on the previous episodes.
Yeah, that sounded like something, that sounded like an Adam lecture, yeah, straight out of season one.
Yeah, absolutely. Big season one energy on this season, guys, for everybody.
to continue with big season one energy, the actual song of this one, though, to me, yeah, this is a bit. I mean, like, it sounds like it's not an outrageous opinion, but it is a bit of a slow new one, you know.
It is, yeah. Yes, it is. I ultimately prefer that kind of thing, but I can absolutely see this being in your lowlights. It trends towards the more kind of Radiohead end of the spectrum, because they make a lot of slow kind of dawdling music, if you want to be unkind about Radiohead, which, so like I kind of am attuned to this kind of thing. But yeah, I absolutely appreciate this. Is kind of, it doesn't have the energy of the previous sort of stuff. It's a weird opener to side two. It's a little bit difficult, to a little bit more slippery. I don't think it's in my top half of the album, for instance, but it's not quite the lowlights. I do think the song does a good job of something that a bunch of songs in this album do a good job of, actually, which is they're about heavy things. We've talked about some heavy stuff already, right? But the songs haven't dragged the album down from being somewhat uplifting and energetic and anthemic. I think even the chorus on this one is like a small anthem. There's like a melancholy to it. But if you just never knew what it is about, you're not like, Jesus Christ, this is a heavy song. Do you know what I mean? To use the comparison point of the intense humming of evil, you listen to that. Even if you don't know what it's about, just the sound of it, you're like, fucking hell, that's oppressive.
Oh yeah, that song sounds evil.
Yeah, this doesn't sound oppressive, even though it's about oppression. They do a good job of kind of like keeping it light, you know what I mean? That makes the transition between something like this and something like the next track much, much easier to swallow in terms of album sequencing, I think. This is called I Believe, and it's also by REM. Snare?
Yeah.
When I was young and full of grace and spirited a rattlesnake, when I was young and fever fell my spirit, I will not tell you on your honor not to tell. Change the difference between what you want and what you need. There's a key, your adventure for today. What do you do between the horns of the day?
Another highlight.
Absolutely, mate. This is the highlight of my life.
Not this moment
also,
right here.
Do you know what this sounds like?
R.E.M.
R.E.M.?
R.E.M.
It doesn't sound a lot like R.E.M.
Yeah, yeah.
It's
I specifically put this sound, and again, this is speculation because I don't know.
Yeah,
I put this sounds like the R.E.M. that is breaking into the mainstream.
Well, you don't know. You don't know, do you? Maybe I know, and maybe I'll tell you at some point. How about
also,
that?
It's got an accordion.
It does have an accordion. Yeah.
So, I mean, and a banjo. Yeah. So, a banjo. Yeah. Come on.
The banjo intro is great. It's a piece of how the song used to sound when they wrote it. And they wrote it around the Fables era. And, of course, the Fables era, they were playing around with more like folk sounds. I don't know if you'll remember this. It's on the track listing for Fables of the Reconstruction. Do you remember this? The songs were all out of order. It was random, and there was one that doesn't appear. And it was called When I Was Young. And it's this.
Right.
It's just it's on the track listing for Fable. It's just not on the album. Okay. And this version instead basically cuts to the Life's Rich pageant sound, the anthemic rock sound. But you do get a little bit more country and sort of like folk-tinged sort of stuff to it.
Yeah, yeah.
And when Buck rewrote the music to it, Mills and Berry just kind of didn't really get it because it's just the same thing that goes round and round and round. And then when Michael Stipe came in and broke it into sections that ended up as verses and choruses, it all made sense and they could kind of like then work towards the arrangement. They had to initially trust in Peter Buck, who was apparently at the time saying, just shut up and learn it. Like, I'm not interested about whether or not you understand it. Just shut up and learn the parts. Steve, what do you think of I Believe by R.E.M.?
It's absolutely standard verse, chorus, verse, chorus, verse, chorus, chorus. But they know how to work a simple song and make it sound great. And there is just pure melody all over this. It's got that Saurus. It's got a Saurus.
It's Saurus, yeah.
But yeah, it's got a bit of southern. It's got the banjo and the rattlesnakes and coyotes.
Yeah.
It's got a bit of religiousness to it. He talks about spirit, and there's a bit where he's sort of talking about the do unto others thing, as you would to you. He says it in a different way. I can't remember the line.
Think of others, others think of you.
Yeah, and then he calls it a little silly, which I quite like. And obviously, I believe. There's not a reason why I think specifically why I really like this. I just sort of think it's great. It's a bop.
It's probably. Probably my favorite REM song of the 80s, I think.
Oh, really?
It's my favorite song of this era, the 80s era of REM, I think. I find it so uplifting and so energetic and so urgent. And the lyrics really split the difference between relatable and mental, I think, which is something that I really like. I think it's about identity. How the things that you believe make up who you are, but they are not necessarily like tangible things or even big things. It's not, do you believe in a higher power, like a god or anything? I don't think it's about religion. It's not, okay, do you believe that they put a man on the moon or anything like that? It's not conspiracy theories. They get into that a little bit later. It's all the little things that make up a human, and it's a song of intent. If you are to believe that the singer should be confused with the song, it's Michael Stipe, or potentially the person that Michael Stipe is inhabiting, planting their flag in the ground and going, this is me, this is what I believe in. And it's, I believe in coyotes, and I believe in time as an abstract, and that my shirt is wearing thin, and I believe in example, and I believe that my throat hurts. And it ultimately comes down to that refrain that change is what I believe in. And I think that's a big central premise of the album, actually. It seems to be about seismic changes. It seems to be about revolution and the changing state of things, and how we need change, and we need to, you know, resist people who want things to stay the same way, the status quo. I think it's a very inspirational song, I think it's kind of speaking on some kind of social revolution against that right-leaning government of the 1980s. There's a lyric in there that's, trust in your calling, make sure your calling is true, think of others, the others think of you. That's the one that you were picking out, Steve. I just think he's really raised his game on writing. I love how he writes overlapping lines that don't necessarily adhere to the melody, or the way that they adhere to the melody makes you hear them differently. So, like, I had always heard, because I can't immediately pick out every lyric, but for years and years and years, all I could pick out was the line that I thought was just, practice, practice makes perfect, perfect. Which is like a fine line on its own, right? That's kind of like a funny kind of like, practice, practice makes perfect, perfect. But it's part of overlapping lines. So it's actually, golden words make practice, practice makes perfect, perfect is a fault, and fault lines change. But yeah, the way he sings it...
I literally had a note of that one being like, that practice, practice makes perfect, perfect is a fault, and fault lines change. It's just like what Steve said earlier with the one about the tiger. Uh-huh. It's just good cadence, just got good, great, it's just a cadence. Good set of lines,
and
just
much clearer. Like even if you don't know the exact words, the vocals are up front, and you're clinging on to that cadence. It's very cool writing. And he's speaking on seismic change, literally in this case, because of the fault lines. And he also says he believes the poles are shifting. So it's a hopeful song. It's full of energy and it's full of zeal. And then there is the more seemingly personal stuff in there, which I really respond to, even if it's not personal to this person who's singing it. It's at least something that speaks to an individual experience rather than an overarching ideology. When I was young and full of grace and spirited a rattlesnake, when I was young and fever fell, my spirit I will not tell. It's just great. It just feels so, I think, urgent is the thing.
It does sound urgent, yeah.
I also really like the line, explain the change, the difference between what you want and what you need. There's the key. I really, really like that. Really, really like that. It feels, in general on this album, this song especially, but in general on this album, it feels much more like he is actually telling you something than giving you a bunch of stuff and going, you figure it out.
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean? Which I think is what we saw on, like, definitely the first two albums. The third album has a bit of that and a bit of, like, here's the fable I'm telling. Here's the story of this old man or whatever. But this one, it feels like he's being didactic. It feels like he's telling you something. He feels like he's got the confidence to be like, this is what I want to say in my song. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Yeah, not feel the need to hide it behind vagary and weird just kind of stuff. I mean, and also I wonder how if that is that all him being confident with it, or is it also the producer, the frog on this one, being like, no, come on, we're gonna make an accessible album, so makes sense as well, actually, is also,
yeah, he
go away challenged, and make more sense.
He challenged him on his lyrics, didn't he? Yeah, absolutely it's that. Yeah. I think that's kind of the last one that kind of does that, because we go on a run here of old songs. I think the next two are from like 1980 and 1981, and I think it kind of shows. By the way, the thing that was printed next to, I believe, on the back of the cover was just, my throat hurts. So anyway, the next one's called What If We Give It Away. Snare. Unbelievable.
Every song.
vocal of What If We Give It Away being followed by the guitar is quite neat, isn't it?
What if we...
Yeah, the guitar does the same thing.
It really is a problem at this point how much I've noticed that it does start with a flam on the snare. It's a drum technique where you hit both sticks at the same time, one slightly before the other, one slightly goes to... And it gives you a bigger sound because you're hitting it.
Oh, interesting.
But it's a flat... Every song starts with
that. I didn't realise that it did it on nearly every song, actually. When I pointed it out in the second episode, I wasn't... Yeah, I didn't realise...
Disappointing, actually, isn't it?
It's disappointing. It's disappointing. What do you think of the song? Steve, I imagine you're all over that chorus at the very least.
Yeah, you've got... No.
No?
No, the harmonies, kind of got everything wrong.
The harmonies and the soaring
nature.
You said
it'd be all over another one and I wasn't. This is fine. I mean, I really like this album. So, like, the songs I'm not as hot on, still really like. It's a song I would struggle to tell you why I like it. I don't know what that means. But, I mean, obviously the harmonies. I love Bill Berry's drumming all over the album. The drums sound incredible. Especially that snare at the start of every song.
What's interesting about the drums is, like, we've said, like, oh, they're a bit more of a fashionable sound. It's that 80s drum sound. But they're not all the way into the big Born in the USA gated reverb kind of thing.
Oh, my God, that is probably the best example of that 80s explosive drum sound. It's like in the bridge, he's doing some really nice stuff on the ride bell in this song as well. But, like, I think we haven't really pointed out how good he sounds in this album, actually. And I wonder if it is, I mean, we kind of touched on it and we've talked about the sound of the drums, and maybe it's to do with the sound that they
isn't the whole thing just better produced in general, right? Yeah. Everything's a bit clearer. Yeah. That there's more going on, but you can hear it more clearly, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, this song is an interesting one to me because I like it a lot. I really like this one, and I didn't before. It came to me on this deep dive. But it feels caught between two places to me, in its composition and in its arrangement. It feels like a much more successful version of the kind of thing that the Flowers of Guatemala was going for. The quiet verses, anthemic chorus. The lift in the chorus in this one is so much more effective than the Flowers of Guatemala for me. And then the verses are like, fine? Whereas I think there was some interesting stuff going on in the verses in the Flowers of Guatemala. And I know I like this one. Right, I really like this one. On some listens, I'm in the first verse and I'm like, why do I like this one so much?
Yeah.
And then the chorus happens and I'm like, oh yeah, that's why. Because I fucking love how soaring that chorus is and the note that Michael Stipe reaches and the melody that he makes. The thing that it seems less successful on is being about anything, right? or being about anything sort of like... tangible. I'm just going to read a snatch of the lyrics that I made out here. Overlooking with a hollow eye, what's pretending isn't right. Eye for order, a hand for what's in line. Couldn't follow, couldn't write. And I thought, I haven't got those correct, so I will quickly look them up, just that verse, and I did get them right. So, and it doesn't really, it's not giving me anything. And it seems much more in line with a bunch of stuff being given to you that he wants you to figure out, which is the opposite of what we said about the last song. Or maybe he doesn't want you to figure out, who fucking knows. But it was written in around 1980, I think. So it's the old style of writing for Stipe, which I think is interesting. It's not a deal breaker for me. Lyrics making sense is not something that I'm massively fussed about. But I do think it's notable on this album. Hello. I am interrupting this episode of our music podcast to talk to you about some more music. I'm here to talk to you about the album Squiggo 1 by Squiggo. That is spelled Squiggo. You can hear it playing underneath my sultry voice right now. And it's out now as well. It was released on the 16th of February, so by the time that this reaches your ears, you can go to all major streaming and distribution services, including Spotify, Bandcamp, and iTunes, and listen to it. You can probably tell from the sound of it that there's some inspirations here from PlayStation and PlayStation 2 soundtracks, if that's your kind of thing. We're thinking Silent Hill, Gran Turismo, Persona 3, Wipeout. A lot of the synths and sample sources that were used in the creation of this album were used on those old soundtracks. And Squiggo also inspired by their recent trip to Japan, particularly the bustling nightlife in Osaka. But if you're not into old video games, you're going to find loads to love here, because they've also taken influence from artists such as M83, Fortet, Aphex Twin, Burial. I can hear a lot of Burial in this, actually. Let's hear a little bit more. There you go. It's kind of electronic, but there's also a wider range of influences, such like, you know, the stuff like ambient, the shoegaze, techno. It's got a kind of down tempo mood. But on the album itself, there's a mixture of styles. You know, some songs are sad and nostalgic. Those are for Steve, I guess. Some are very, very chilled. That's for Lucas. And some might make you want to dance. Oh, apparently there's a scary one. I'm not even going to read that bit. I'm not even going to read it out. Anyway, it's out now, wherever you get your music. Squiggo 1 by Squiggo. Go and have a listen. Lucas, you said in episode 1 you were maybe like slightly... Am I right thinking you said you were slightly surprised that some of it is older material? Is that right?
No, I didn't say I was surprised by it.
Just that it was notable.
It was just something I read. It was just a fact. It was just a trivia.
It's just something I said. In the way the song sounds, you wouldn't go like, oh, that's early REM, though.
I imagine a huge amount of production and all the rest of it. Like, there's right, a version of the song that sounds, yeah.
Yeah. What did you think of it?
The one, the most on the album, the one I would describe as filler.
Yeah,
like, the most kind of nothing, just a song, just kind of there, just kind of inoffensively normal and not that
now,
interesting.
Now, I've got that for the next song. But I think the next song is doing something that this one kind of isn't. I don't know. Again, I trend towards the plodding, dawdling, slow, depressing Radiohead nature of things, so I like this one.
What this one's doing is sounding like the Police.
It does sound a bit like the Police, and they are contemporaries, of course. Exactly.
We all know the bassist of the Police, don't we?
Yeah, Morris Day.
Yeah.
even if the lyrics don't elicit much emotion from me, the way that they are sung and the music surrounding them does elicit that emotion. Cannot explain to you how mega I find that chorus to be. It's so mega. Yeah.
Are the lyrics right on the site I'm on? Where there's a line, here's the trailer, Tom. He loves to...
How would I
say... men's names, just normal men's names,
just normal.
Because on
names.
The next track,
yeah,
it says Kevin heard it on the radio, and then we've got What's the Frequency, Kenneth?
Does and then there's like a song, and then the out? Last song on this album is called Superman, and that's a normal man's name.
It's got the word man in
exactly.
It,
yeah. I didn't know that there are a bunch of names in the next song because I've not looked at the lyrics, and that's the one that I cannot tell you a single word from. I don't think. And What's the Frequency, Kenneth has a very specific origin that obviously you
okay,
don't know
right,
yet.
Yeah, okay, yeah.
Well, we'll move on to Just a Touch then, because we're already talking about it. But I will say that the thing that's next to What If We Give It Away on the cover is A Mighty Big Word, which I don't think is in the song, but might illuminate for our listeners something about it. Who knows? Just a Touch.
Yes, sir.
rockabilly sort of piano at the end of the chorus there. More energy, full of energy.
More energy.
For the second
time
on the album, I think
more
it's
passion.
A bit like is that piano, the piano-iness again, adding a
Who?
Forsyth.
Bruce Forsyth.
I can hear that. Yeah, for sure. This second side is like a roller coaster, man. Goes up and down. Flowers of Guatemala, I believe, to What If We Give It Away to Just a Touch is like a real, so like fucking tonal whiplash. Continues the trend of What If We Give It Away lyrically, because again, I think this is one of the first songs they ever wrote as a band.
It dates back to their pre-Chronic Town period as a party band in Athens, Georgia.
Yeah, okay,
which also
cool.
makes sense as to why you can't make out any fucking lyrics.
Absolutely. It's potentially just a mishmash of imagery and maybe some non sequiturs, but I couldn't tell you. I have seen Stipe say it's about Elvis Presley's death and how the news travelled. But again, I'm going to have to take his word for it. I'm not really sure. Again, not a deal breaker because I love the energy of it. This is the most clear example maybe of the really wild live version of Michael Stipe that comes out on this record, which is maybe why I couldn't make out anything. But I do respond to that energy, you know? Who else is responding to that energy with me, guys? Have we got a lot of energy in the room?
Yeah.
It's definitely, from the last one, it's a definite...
That's me
going upwards, by the way. I was going up with my hand.
Yeah, all that stuff. I love that. Because he's just having a great time, right?
Steve put his arms up like he was on a roller coaster.
I put them up in the air like I just don't bloody care.
It seemed like you just didn't care. Just
I just
like
didn't give a fuck, actually. I put them up like I didn't care.
Okay, all right, mate.
I love, sorry. I really like the energy on this. Right.
Oh, no, sorry. Just the hands can go down. The energy can come up.
Just a little bit more. And now it passed normal.
Yeah, there we go.
Yeah, it's fine. Yeah, just all of that. Like, it does sound like it's just a live take. It makes way more sense that it's an older song now. Because it does feel a little bit out of place in a way on the album.
It does a little bit. Yeah, it's separate. In the same way that the next song is also... weirdly separate, but we'll get to that. The title, Just a Touch, is the catchphrase of an Elvis impersonator that performed at the restaurant Stipe worked at when he was 17. The catchphrase he
did
would
he
say
have
was,
a black quiff?
Yeah, but the catchphrase he would say is, "Is it Elvis or just a touch?" Which is something, isn't it? But anyway, Stipe was working. Stipe doesn't mean anything. Stipe was working, and the impersonator was performing on the night that Elvis died. And apparently people like rushed the stage and the news like broke out around the restaurant and stuff like that. Yeah. And there's a nod to Patti Smith at the end, one of Stipe's primary influences. He's shouting, "I'm so young, I'm so goddamn young," which is from her cover version of Privilege, Set Me Free, from her 1978 album Easter, which itself is a nod to something she did at the end of her cover of My Generation by The Who, which was released as a B-side to her single Gloria in 1976. You got it?
Yep.
That's you're on top layers. Of
that? Yeah. You're on top of that? Lovely.
I am on top of it, Adam, and tell you why.
Yeah.
Because I wrote it down also, so I already knew it.
Oh, lovely. Lovely stuff.
Yeah. So I had time to read it a few times to sort of...
Lovely. You know. Lovely. Yeah. To really get to grips with it.
I mean, this just sounds like it was meant to be played live, which I mean makes sense because it dates back to them being a party band, so that makes sense. Because it is just fun on stage, bopping around like a bunch of silly boys energy.
This is what I said
about... Steve's waving his arms in the air again.
This is what I said for
Underneath
the Bunker. They're a party band. They're a covers band. It never truly leaves them, you know?
You can take the band at the party. You can take the band band.
You can
at
take
the
band away from
band,
the party, but you can't take the party away from the band. Yes, we did it. We did it. So I consider this next one to be the last song of the album. You know, the quotes around the album. Should we hear it?
No, I think we should stop.
I'm going to say it the way I've always said it, I suppose. This is Swan Swan H. Right? Yeah.
Swan Swan Hummingbird. noisy cats are we, growing doggy Boris Cross. Swan, swan, hummingbird, hurrah, we're all free now. Long, low time ago, people talk to me. Johnny Reb, what's the price of fans? 40 apiece or 3 for $1? Hey, Captain, don't you wanna buy some bone chains and toothpicks, night wings or hair chains? Here's your wooden greenback sing. Wooden
swan, swan, H. What noisy cats are we? Is what's next to it on the cover. What are we making of it?
It's also like a vibe. Like the what's it bloody called now? Flipping, what's it bloody called? Like the Underneath the Bunker. Nowhere near as much so, but it's kind of a bit of a vibey thing.
Sounds totally different to anything else on the album, right? It's more of a folk sound and seems wrapped up in the same kind of Southern Gothic style as a lot of Fables was. If you gave this like a murkier production, this would fit on Fables of the Reconstruction, but yeah, it's not. It's like the darkness is all in the songwriting and the tone rather than the production this time.
That sort of American Gothic or just like a historical American vibe of
it's
like
folk. It's pure folk.
Bone chains, and which I thought was bone change. Which is like when you pay with small bits of bone.
Yeah.
But actually were grisly souvenirs that were sometimes made from the remains of soldiers killed on the battlefields of the Civil War.
Right, so yes, it's a Civil War song. And it also it mentions Johnny Reb, who was the character used to portray the Confederate Army during the US Civil War. So full on Southern Gothic territory. And it has that tone of telling a story around a campfire. There's a bit of mystery to it. Swan, swan, hummingbird, hurrah, we are all free now. He's referencing slavery. But direct references are very few and far between on this song. It takes a much more poetic approach. But yeah, it's all in that vibe. A cup of rhyme, the whiskey is water, the water is wine. Six of one, half dozen the other, tell that to the captain's mother. Hey, captain, don't you want to buy some bone chains and toothpicks? Yeah, yeah, man. Yeah, man, it's a whole vibe.
I really like that, the line. Is it cup of rhyme, did you say?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I thought it was just a cup of rye, like, because rye is a type of whiskey. So a cup of rye, but the whiskey is water, the water is wine. That's a lovely little...
Yeah,
little section of that.
I knew Steve would like that just, line. I don't know why. Yeah. I just think it's Steve really enjoy that.
Because it mentions booze.
Because booze. Yeah.
Because it mentions whiskey specifically, like, and Steve loves Steve loves like whiskey rock. You know, as we've discussed.
Yeah.
So does that make this whiskey rock? Because it's a rock album. This song mentions whiskey.
Yeah,
must be right.
It's whiskey rock. This is just like Avenged Sevenfold.
Really is. Really is. I've always said that. We've always said that.
When you get to the end of the album at this point, which apparently is the end of the album.
Hey, I don't I'm just making it. You don't have to agree with me. You don't have to agree with me.
Rightly or wrongly. You've got like kind of punk songs, like the last one. You've got sort of straight pop songs, straight hard rock songs, like a Latin sounding song about hiding a nuclear bunker. And then you've got this kind of straight folk song about the Civil War.
Yeah,
this is really varied. You can't just go, oh, this is the rock out. This is the hard rock album, which like you'd be forgiven for thinking because of the opener. And yeah, there's some songs that quote unquote go harder, right, than other albums. But it's really varied. It's all over the place in genre. It's cool.
You're echoing what I've said about the previous albums as well, and I think the variation is maybe more distinct on this one. But I think that's always what they've done. They're always a mixed bag, I think.
Yeah,
yeah. I mean, I love this. I think it's some of my argument for this is the last track on the album is I just really want it to be. You know, yeah. It's like a really good closer and something that REM always
doing a thing.
It's doing a thing. And that is what REM do with their closers. I'm surprised we haven't picked this out yet. The closers that we've had so far are all a bit slightly removed from the album that they close. Think of Wendell G, you think of Little America, you think of West of the Fields. They don't always sit the most comfortably in with the sound of that album. And that's the case for Swan Swan H as well. Mike Mills is like annoyed about the title. He didn't know that Stipe was going to call it Swan Swan H. And he would have vetoed it for being too pretentious if he'd known he was going to do that. It was called Swan Swan Hummingbird.
Well, yeah, obviously.
Yeah. Stipe intended the H to be said huh. So it was going to be Swan Swan huh. But it didn't stick. Doesn't make everyone just says Swan Swan H.
But again, also still just as stupid.
Just as stupid. And Stipe agrees with you. He now also thinks it's too pretentious and on numerous occasions has publicly apologised for calling it Swan Swan H, which is quite nice. Bill Berry is annoyed that he didn't sit on his hands for it. He's annoyed that he put drums on it at all. They're quite faint right. And in the background, but he thinks it would have been better without percussion. And just a Mike Mills bass watch, I think you get a really clear idea, if you aren't attuned to what instruments do what, of how Mills uses the bass, because I think he's playing a bass part on an acoustic guitar.
Cool.
Yeah. You can hear it. It's panned slightly left, and Peter Buck is strumming, and there's a low end picked bit of guitar. I think that's Mike Mills. But then he also adds in the accordion, so that's pretty cool
of course,
as well.
Yeah,
not loads of rock bands with a fucking accordion solo or whatever it is that happens in the middle of this song.
I did see a funny comment on a blog that I was reading that said, ironically, the one song actually about life during the Reconstruction era does not appear on the album Fables of the Reconstruction.
Yeah, that is funny, actually. That is funny. That line I picked out, the six of one, half dozen of other, is an answer to the question posed before it, which is, what's the price of heroes? And on the album that takes in revolution and social consciousness and identity and standing up for what you think is right, the album comes to a point where it's suggesting, does it matter? It's like a curiously downbeat sentiment, and I it's where I consider the album to finish, on that downbeat sentiment that examines the human cost of the grand ideologies that the rest of the album has been kind of facing or confronting. But similar to side one, it's not the last song that we will hear from the album, so this is Superman. Bit of organ or keyboard going on in there. Slightly new sound for the album that we haven't really touched on. Steve, I get the impression that you love this for some reason.
I did.
Okay.
I did love it.
You did.
The first time I heard the album, this song like gave me chills, and I think I don't know if it's because it like it comes out like a reprise of after the album finishes, right? And it's all those very close harmonies and all that kind of stuff, and it's kind of it's got like a 60s-ish feeling to it.
Yeah.
But then I found out it's a cover,
and that's what made it diminish for you.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And then I became very disappointed in REM for putting that at the end of their album.
Well, but then this is my thing: is like there's so much to point to it being a hidden track. Yeah. In the same way that Manic Street Preachers put a cover of John Lennon's Working Class Hero at the end of Send Away the Tigers, but it's just a hidden track.
Yeah, yeah. But it's not on this, is it?
But the difference is they have the technology to make it actually hidden, I guess.
No, you're
because
right.
There's a
yeah,
gap
yeah.
and stuff, whereas on a vinyl, there's not the, like...
This is how we've been presented it to us on Spotify.
Well, exactly. It's not on the track listing, remember?
On a CD, if you skip, does it go to track 12?
Yeah. But it does for Working Class Hero as well.
Okay.
Some bonus tracks don't do that, do they? Some bonus tracks are like...
Yeah.
Some bonus tracks are put at the end of like the last song. But I'd say actually the majority of them are just a track you can like skip to, you know?
But also some are ones you can't skip to as well. They're like hidden.
Yeah.
Like somehow CD knows that it can only go to naturally and not with a manual skip or the other way around.
There's loads of stuff that points to this being a hidden track. Lead vocals by Mike Mills. That's not
Michael's
Knight.
Yeah, I was going to say it's not.
Obviously, it's a cover. It's not on the track list, as we've just said. And also, check out the gap between Swan Swan Ha and Superman.
The whiskey is water, the water is wine.
That's ages, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's not even connected to the album. So even on vinyl, it's supposed to sound a bit like separate from the album. So
I made that another 10 seconds or something. To make
I could have done.
Adam, you must love this.
Because it's Godzilla.
Because it's got Godzilla samples.
Yeah, sure. The opening sound clip is a recording of a Godzilla toy. That's the noise it makes when you pull the string. I think they sped it up.
That's great.
Roughly translated from Japanese, it says, "This is a special news report. Godzilla has been sighted in Tokyo Bay. The attack on it by the self-defense force has been useless. He is heading towards the city." Ah! do you want to hear the original? Do you want to hear the thing that they are covering? Here we go.
Yeah.
It's a pretty straight cover. That's by The Clique, and it's from 1969. And it was a cover that Mike and Bill did in their band, the Corn Cob Webs, after Peter had showed them the song from his like extensive record collection. Stipe, not really fussed about it, which is why he isn't singing it. He's doing some backup vocals, but he's just like, whatever. Mike Mills said about it, "It doesn't have a whole lot of depth, but pop music doesn't always need depth." And it's, you know, it's I do think it's separate from the album. I think Swan Swan Ha is the summation of the album, and this is like a little track that they just sort of bundled at the end because they're like a fun band. Do you know what I mean? That's why it's not on the track listing. Rolling Stone called it an irresistibly cheesy psychedelic grunge rocker.
Now
that is a retrospective review, okay, but that piqued my interest, so we should pick out that word a little bit just in relation to the album as a whole as well, okay? Just to take a definition of grunge quickly. Grunge is an alternative rock genre and subculture which emerged during the mid-1980s in the US. Grunge fuses elements of punk rock and heavy metal. The genre featured the distorted electric guitar sound used in both genres, although some bands performed with more emphasis on one or the other. Like these genres, grunge typically uses electric guitar, bass guitar, drums, and vocals. Grunge also incorporates influences from indie rock. Now that just reads like a checklist of things that you can tick this album off as having, doesn't it?
Yeah, that's true.
I think the actual origins of grunge are not this. I think it's much more, it's more like the hardcore punk bands of the 80s, like Black Flag. But you can definitely see this in some ways as a proto-grunge record. The thing that makes it not very grunge is how light and uplifting it is on the whole.
Yeah. I was going to say, that's... Yeah.
But I think if you mixed this with the mood of Fables of the Reconstruction, you'd have something quite close to grunge, I reckon. Mm-hmm. Anyway, that's the end of the album. What did you guys think about it? From the way that... I don't want to tell anybody what to do or how they feel. From the way that we've been talking about it, seems like it's our favourite so far.
Yeah, I would say so, yeah. It's the most... I mean, it's not surprising for me, really, is it? It's the most, like, listenable and sort of accessible and immediately catchy and sort of, you know, enjoyable to listen to. It's not work like the last one. It's a bit more, it's a bit less like oblique and sort of, you know, I don't know, we'll do what we fancy doing. There's the first couple. It's a bit more like they're starting to, well, yeah, they're having commercial instincts.
Yes.
So it makes sense.
Most bands from like album one are like, we need to sell some copies. And REM are like, nah. Go on then. Tell us how you feel about it. Tell us what your lowlights are. Tell us what your highlights are. Give us your score out of 10, Lucas.
I think the ones that I like the most are probably going to be fairly obvious. Actually, maybe not, because I think Chaya Hoga.
Mm-hmm.
Is not an obvious pick for me, because it's not about the sound and the enjoyment of listening to it.
Yeah.
Which is more my normal thing. But I think it just painted such a word picture that it that puts it in the highlights for me. And then I believe. Because it's then the obvious one. That is one.
Absolutely.
Low lights will be like, sadly, Flowers of Guatemala and What If We Give It Away, just because it's like probably the most fillery.
So just the slow ones, basically, right? Like the slow rock songs. That's interesting.
Yeah.
That's really interesting.
Seven.
Lovely okay. Stuff. For someone who has been saying like, oh, I've been struggling with this band or whatever, that's a big score. Seven's a big score.
Well, yeah, because compared to the last album, there's a lot more.
So
I love this album. It was so easy to keep coming back to, which was like a welcome relief after Fables, which was a little challenging.
Yeah.
I think it's energetic, it's varied, and it's interesting. And it just really keeps you engaged throughout the whole thing. Like, it's definitely more accessible. And it's definitely a reaction to Fables in that respect. But, like, it's a really good turn of direction for me, anyway. And it's full of, like, melody and hooks. But you've also got the weird stuff in there, which I'm really glad they didn't go too safe. Yeah, they went more commercial, but they did it the way that REM go, slightly more commercial.
Yeah.
To do lowlights.
Cool.
I know you don't consider it as a track on the album, but we covered it as a track on the album. So Superman would be in my lowlights.
Whoa, from giving you chills to one of the weakest things on the album.
Yeah.
Devastating.
It let me down. what if I give it away?
Oh, no, come on now.
No, I meant the song Superman. What if I give that away?
Oh, right, yeah, we'll give that away. That's fine.
The other low light would be What If I Give It Away by REM.
Yeah, fair.
Highlights. Ooh. These Days and Fall On Me, maybe?
Oh yeah, Fall On Me.
Begin was there for a while. There's loads in there because it's a 9 out of 10, I think.
It's big. It's a big score.
Yeah. It's not quite perfect or a masterpiece for me. I absolutely loved it.
Wow.
Really, really great.
It's a big score.
You're right, it's my favourite REM album so far. Really.
It's, Yeah, it's I mean, that makes sense. You've both gone 0.5 above your highest score so far. So yeah, that makes sense. It's our favorite so far. It's my
unless you're about to give it like a two.
Was my did I like Reckoning more than Murmur? I didn't know.
No, you gave them the same score.
Oh, they're the same. That's
yeah. I mean, it's also my favorite so far. I was reading about the artwork and Bill Berry saying that Michael Stipe insists that Bill Berry's eyebrows are the reason that he wanted him to be in the band and what first drew Stipe to him. And Stipe has apparently told him that his eyebrows are a reminder to him of why the band got together. People who like each other and have fun making music. And the top half of the artwork represents that. And the bottom half represents the album's very lofty goal of reckoning with America, both modern and past, I suppose. And so the album does have a foot in both camps. It's like political and it's heavy and it's downbeat. It's also fun and energetic and uplifting. It has softer songs. It has heavier songs. It has new songs. It has some of the first material that they ever wrote. And so the fact that it holds all of those things together as well as it does is remarkable, I think. And because we watched them try and fail to do a similar thing with Fables of the Reconstruction, that was a real mix. This is also a mix, but they don't sound nearly as confused. They sound like confident and reinvigorated and energized, especially Michael Stipe, who really comes into his own on this album. His writing is so much more focused, it's more lucid, it's clearer, it's more direct, and his singing is incredible. The way that he uses his voice on this album is mad. There was a sticker on the UK pressing that had four words printed on it that they also used on the backstage passes for the forthcoming tour, and it just said Mammoth. Huge, colossal, understated. And I think that really sums up the album. Because we've had Big before, but this is kind of a stripped back Big. It's not a 64-piece orchestra like Muse would do to get Big. It's not songs that suddenly drop into being something much bigger like Radiohead do. And it's not more instruments than you can fit in a room like Lauryn Hill uses. It's somehow understated and modest, while also being big and anthemic. And I think that's down to their complete and total grip on interesting and satisfying songwriting. Something I would say about this album is it's deeply, deeply satisfying. And their ability to do that is almost invisible. It's deeply impressive. I also think it's enormously fun and amazingly robust and very touching at times and genuinely uplifting and inspiring in places. And I do think it's one of their masterpieces. So I'm going to give it a 10 out of 10, yeah. Which I don't think is any surprise. It's one of my favourite albums of all time. My lowlights are Just a Touch and Superman. There you go. And my highlights are These Days and I Believe, which I think is what Lucas would say. Well, they're the obvious ones. And I agree, but they're just obviously fucking great. Do you know what I mean? Okay, let's wrap this up. When Life's Rich Pageant was released, it was released to, I don't know, what do you reckon?
Universally negative reviews.
Okay, you're so close. Universal acclaim.
Positive.
Yeah. Rolling Stone called it brilliant and groundbreaking. Here are some more quotes from various publications. Every note fizzes and cracks with urgency. Invigorating. Paints a swirling, impressionistic portrait of a country at the moral crossroads. And also, by giving the melodic leads their own space, Gemmon emphasizes the muscle in Berry's beats and the intricate interaction between the rhythm section. A retrospective review from The Guardian said it may represent the band at their absolute zenith, which I think is really interesting. I think it depends on the kind of REM that you like. That critical appreciation, the glowing reviews, also translated into sales and appreciation from the music buying public. It charted at number 21 on the Billboard Top 200 Albums chart and remained on that chart for 32 weeks. That's their highest chart position so far, right? It was also their first record to go gold in the USA. So that's 500,000 copies, and it did it in 6 months. So just for comparison, I know we talked about this before, but for comparison, the first three records, Murmur, Reckoning, Fables of the Reconstruction, they all went gold at the same time in 1991 off the back of further success. So it took them between 8 and 6 years to achieve what Life's Rich Pageant achieved in 6 months.
Christ.
That's pretty mental.
Notable, isn't it?
Notable, yeah.
So I would say that this is the band's tentative step into the more mainstream end of things. And I know we've talked about album 7 or 8 or the early 90s and when they quote-unquote break, but it is much more of a steady climb, I think, and this is the first rung on that ladder. We are just talking about the US, because in the UK, Life's Rich Pageant charts worse than Fables did at number 43. But in the US, yeah. Their stock is rising. And another sign of that is that after years of being completely ignored by commercial radio and existing basically only on college radio and smaller radio stations, when the band released the first single from this album, which is Fall On Me, a month after the album is released, it was played by commercial radio stations and it charted at number 5 in the Billboard Mainstream Rock Tracks chart. The second single was Superman, weirdly, and charted.
Stupid.
Okay. It charted at 17 in that same chart. Those are the only two singles from the album. There is a creep into the mainstream there. 2 months after the album is released, the pageantry tour starts in September 1986. So that's a 9-month break from touring for the band, which I feel like they've earned, you know. And another marker of their increasing popularity, the North American leg of the pageantry tour runs from the 5th of September to the 26th of November. That's 2.5 months just touring the USA and Canada. It encompasses 63 shows, and these are now mostly bigger venues, okay? In some markets, it's those 2,000-capacity theatres we've seen them play. Like, there's a handful of those, but it's mostly 5,000 to 10,000 people amphitheatres and auditoriums. So it's basically an arena tour, a 63-date, 2.5-month arena tour.
Blimey.
They do not tour this album outside of North America. There is no world tour. They were just burned out on that kind of stuff. They didn't strictly need it. And while 63 shows for the year is a lot, it's about half of what they did the year Fables was released. So they're taking it kind of easier. Now, bear with me here. Footage for this tour is incredibly scarce. And as such, we're not going to do a commentary next week, basically. There's some tangential stuff that we could do. It would be very casual. We'll discuss it off air. I'm not convinced it's worth doing. But there is no pro shot footage. And the audience recordings that are made with like 1980s like camcorders, they leave a lot to be desired. Let's put it right, that way. Okay. I can try and give you a vibe of the tour briefly as we're wrapping up. There's a big group of people that have usually bought tickets in order to attend the event. Yeah, and they all stand or they sit facing kind of like a similar direction, and it's usually looking towards this quite wide but short platform that is called a stage, and that's where the band perform. Yeah,
oh yeah,
just gonna give you a vibe.
I am familiar with the concept.
The stage right has lights above and beside it. Okay.
Yeah.
Now here's an interesting distinction when he's talking about 10,000 person arenas. You have to remember, screens at gigs were not commonplace yet. They kind of happened, but mostly at stadium shows. If you went to see the Rolling Stones at a stadium, yeah, you'd have some screens. Screens at concerts, as we know them, didn't really start happening until the 90s. The Jumbotron was first used in 1980, and it was CRT, not LED. So, which is kind of crazy, actually. It wasn't manufactured to the kind of standard that would be of any use to concerts until 1985, when Sony debuted it at a tech expo in Japan. And that's only a year before this tour. So those kind of screens, not in the budget. So if you were at the back of the 10,000-person auditorium, you could see fuck all. But also remember, that was totally the norm. People came expecting to primarily hear the music, and maybe you'd see a bit of a light show. What bands did use was projections onto kind of like pull-down screens. It was usually kind of like adjacent imagery, though. It wasn't like a feed of the band. And REM didn't use that either until the next tour, of which there is also basically no footage. Let me give you a sense of the gigs. They played between 24 and 27 songs each night. And to give you an idea of how they varied their set list, they played 63 shows and there was not a single song that was played every night of the tour.
Right.
In those 63 nights, they played 109 different songs.
Not even Bad Day?
Not even Bad Day. And those songs included covers and B-sides and new songs. I don't think there's a single repeated set list. The vibe kind of oscillates depending on the show. They're a bit more sedate than the earlier, smaller shows, but still kind of suitably rowdy in places, to the point where before one performance, Michael Stipe comes onto stage before their set time and says the following: "A couple of times on our tour, we had to stop the shows because people in the floor up front were pushing too much and getting hurt. I would like to make the request before we come on stage that everyone please try to be civil tonight so that we don't have to stop playing, especially the people directly in front of the stage. I mean what I say and I don't want to have to stop the show. If we see anything going on from stage, we're not going to send security guards out to stop it because they'll beat your face in. We're just going to stop playing and walk off. So try to maintain some kind of peace, all right? We'll be on in a little bit. Try to back off some. Thank you." It's very polite. At one of the shows, they make good on that. And after someone faints in the crowd due to a bit of a crush, they leave early after like half the set and they don't come back. Some more casual attendees, who you would expect to be drawn in by the, you know, the more accessible album, seem to struggle with the weirder and artier side of R.E.M., and Michael Stipe is still met with booing when he does something like a spoken word piece or an a cappella cover of Moon River or starts to sing the Incy Wincy Spider. Again, he would just walk off. He's not going to confront in any way. At one point, actually, someone gets on stage and takes the microphone from Michael Stipe before he's like escorted out by security. And Stipe's reaction is to, once again, just walk off stage and wait for that to blow over. At one person... one show, a person invades the stage and tries to just take Peter Buck's guitar from him, and Buck kind of like shakes him off, and the guy jumps back into the crowd. So Peter Buck takes his guitar off and then jumps into the crowd after the guy and starts going around the crowd, like trying to like find him, trying to look for him before returning to the stage and then offering to meet him afterwards. So don't fuck with Peter Buck.
Don't fuck with the Buck.
You can fuck with any of the others because they'll just walk off stage, but Peter Buck will follow you. So just
he will find you.
Just be aware of that.
Peter Buck has a certain set of skills.
They round off the tour and the year with a 3-night stand at the Fox Theatre in Atlanta, Georgia. So kind of a homecoming vibe. They play to around 15,000 people in total over those 3 nights. And that seems as good a place as any to leave them. It's quite satisfying so far because we've mostly been doing it in years. Our group of episodes on each album tend to be contained within a single year. Today, we've just done 1986 in three episodes. Last time we did 1985 and that was it. It's lovely. Before we go, what are you expecting for the next REM album?
More of the same, I think. I don't necessarily mean they're going to do the part two to this, but I think they will continue with this trend.
More towards the
slightly
mainstream.
Slightly more mainstream, yeah. And a bit more rockin'.
What do you think, Lucas?
I think the one after the next one is the one that I'm aware is like them breaking into the mainstream, which makes me think it would be surprising if they did a detour towards like odd.
Well, I mean, I suppose I'm asking about the next REM album. I'm asking about the fifth REM album. That's not what we're covering next, which is interesting, actually.
What are we covering
but
next?
We'll talk about that. We'll talk about that at a different time. We should wrap up this episode. Before we go, I do just want to dedicate this episode to one of our biggest mate subscribers, Kelly Lovell. This episode is yours. I hope you like REM. I hope you like Life's Rich
Pageant. Thanks, Kelly.
Yeah, thanks, Kelly. Thank you for subscribing.
Now you're my best friend.
It means an awful lot to us that people are subscribing to this. It's absolutely excellent. I'd also like to read an email, if you might indulge me. It's from one of our listeners, if that's all right.
Yeah.
Okay, great. This is from Adam Rogers. Hello, big mates. Long-time listener, first-time emailer. Lovely.
Love that.
I've just listened to the REM introduction episode, and what Adam said about REM being a gateway band really interested me. It made me realise that this is also the case for me. I, too, had mainly been into different forms of pop and chart music until I first heard REM when I was 10 years old in around 1993. I think it would have been something from Automatic for the People. Something about the melodic pop sound, but with a darker, cooler edge, hooked me in. I soon started buying everything REM-related that I could find, and my love of the band soon led me on to other forms of guitar music. The release of the heavier album, Monster, was perfectly timed for me, as I was getting into heavier rock bands at the time, and then 97's New Adventures in Hi-Fi satisfied me with a mix of guitar-based rock tracks with some more melodic Automatic for the People type songs mixed in with some new, weirder stuff. After this, I kind of left REM on the back burner a bit, as I was more heavily into other bands, Mannix and Radiohead being my top two. God, do we have the podcast for you, Adam Rogers? I found Up underwhelming, and quite quickly they became a band I used to be into. At Glastonbury 2003, I only caught the start of their set before moving across site to watch the cooler and edgier Primal Scream instead. This would have been an unthinkable move a few years earlier. Anyway, a couple of years ago, I bought a job lot of all of their early albums, up to and including Monster, on vinyl, and my love for REM was reborn. In conclusion, there's something bloody special about REM, but like Adam, I can't quite put my finger on what it is. It's telling that I've listened to your seasons on Mannix and Radiohead as they went out, and yet only now have I felt compelled to email you. I can only put this down to the mysterious magic of REM, and I can't wait to do the deep dive with you and hear all your thoughts, positive and negative, along the way. My favourite albums are and always will be the 1-2 punch of Automatic for the People and Monster. Thanks for reading my email. I will be in touch again in future to continue my campaign for a future season on Talking Heads or LCD Sound System. Regards, Adam Rogers. Adam Rogers, they would just more or less be the same season. I don't think we can do both. I think we've got to do one or the other, really. I think we've got to do one or the other. That brings us to the end of another episode. Thank you very much, everyone, for listening. Our next episode is out next Monday, so come and join us for that. But before you do, come and let us know what you think of Life's Rich Pageant. Is it that reinvigorated sound that we talked about? When did you get to the album? What are your favourite tracks? Just come and tell us everything. You can find us on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook at What Is Music Pod, TikTok at What Is Music. And if you want to send in something a little bit longer, like Adam did, we can read it out on the show. You can email us, whatismusicpod@gmail.com. If you liked what you heard here and thought I'd like to hear more of that, please do head over to our Patreon page where you'll find all kinds of extra podcast shows. There's one about the Mannix. There's one about loads of different types of music and themed playlists. There's bonus commentaries. There's music discussion episodes. Ad-free episodes of this show that you're listening to right now. There's a pretty amazing Discord community and a sense of theatre. Head to patreon.com/whatismusicpod or follow the link in the show notes for up to 2 podcast episodes every single week. There are other ways that you can support us if you'd like to. Buy some of our merchandise, whatismusicpod.redbubble.com. Send us a little one-off donation, ko-fi.com, ko-fi.com/whatismusic. Still, the best way you can support us, listening to the show, rating the show, subscribing to the show, sharing it with your REM or music-loving friends, all of that stuff. That about does it. Thanks again for listening. We'll see you next week. But for now, it's the end of the episode as we know it. And I feel as though I have a really sore throat. My throat hurts.
Your throat.
I feel sleepy.
I feel it's complicated.
Yeah, like the film, it's complicated.
Yeah, I feel like the film, it's complicated. Change is what I